cost of the product. You know, $20 out of $500 revenue, who cares about the product cost? So we put a task force together, and we came up with some simple guidelines. We were able to reduce 8 or 10% off the cost of goods. 8 or 10% off of 20%. Big, big changes. All that just comes right to the bottom line in terms of profit. And so it became obvious that the thing to do when you have a problem is let everybody worry about it. And so that's what we started doing with PSS. We started reporting to everybody what happens. Then we had some really simple guidelines, like, why not, on every release of your product, have half as many calls per unit or half as much time per unit as you had before as an objective? And then you start thinking, well, how do you solve that problem? Well, it's obvious. You have to work on the highest volume problems. So if printing envelopes is a high volume problem, then put some folks on worrying about making that better. Maple set a target of limiting total support costs to 8% of product revenues, compared to about 16% for WordPerfect, according to Microsoft estimates. Again, there were wide differences among products. About 7% of Excel and Word revenues went to product support, and 6% of revenues for consumer products. This compared to 20% of Windows revenues and 25% of Windows NT revenues. Microsoft quickly found out that corporate client-server products such as Windows NT and LAN Manager are more expensive to support because they generate more and longer calls than more common PC software and require more sophisticated support engineers. A successful move into these new product domains, therefore, has required a significant parallel investment in the support organization. The pricing structure, as well as an analysis of the correlation between the type of product and the type of calls received, are essential to control and forecast demand for phone support on new and existing products. Some products generate most calls in the first few weeks or months, while others generate calls over longer periods. Microsoft and other PC software companies generally give customers free support, at least for the first 3 months after purchasing a product, but customers have to pay for the phone call, except for WordPerfect. The industry trend, including at Novell's WordPerfect division for its new products, has been to move away from unlimited free support to fee-based support. To deal with products that it expects to generate calls for many months, if not years, Microsoft has also instituted pricing policies comparable to what other firms have done in other industries. For basic products, such as Word and Excel, customers can receive free support during working hours via a toll call. For these and most other Microsoft products, after 90 days, customers pay $2 per minute on a 900 number for 24-hour support. Customers who want support 24 hours a day, such as for corporate products, also have a choice of payment schemes. $2 per minute, $25 a call, $195 a year, or $20,000 a year for premium support services. With this pricing schedule, on average, 50% of calls for a new product over its lifetime, including all versions, come in the first 6 months. Support technology. Microsoft's use of computers and communications technology to make customer support less costly, as well as to analyze incoming information more effectively, takes three forms: the computer system or workbench used by the support engineers, the telephone system, and the automated information services available to customers. The PSS workbench includes a set of integrated tools created by Microsoft's internal information technology group running on a high-powered PC. These tools track issues raised by customers: call volumes, lengths, wait times, calls per product, calls per customer type, and calls per problem type. And they store customer-specific information on system configurations and issues. They also create specific to-do lists for individual engineers to follow up on, track individual workloads, produce reports based on the workbench data, facilitate ordering of no-charge items for customers, such as replacement disks, and provide access to the Microsoft Knowledge Base, which is an electronic database or library of technical support information. Support engineers can search through the database using regular search words and phrases. They can also add to the database by writing articles to answer previously unasked questions. Microsoft distributes part of this knowledge base to customers on CD-ROMs and over online networks, including CompuServe and Genie. The phone system includes a feature called Wrap-Up. This allows technicians to punch in digits on the telephone in order to record some minimal information on each call that Microsoft receives. Mark Seidenberg, a PSS product development consultant and veteran of 9 years in Microsoft, praised the technology as the Cadillac of phone systems, which includes a software bridge to the PSS workstations. The objective of the workstation in phone systems is to analyze customer calls quickly and create lists of prioritized problems for the product development organization. Seidenberg described the process and benefits of logging information from a customer phone call. Every customer contact is an opportunity to improve our products. We get some amount of information about every call. Right now, there's a standard template for each product with some standard categories that it starts out with. We want to see overall some big area stuff, like how many calls are on setup, how many are on printing, how many are on general usage, how many are on the operating environment, how many are on interoperability. Then, below that, we track number of features or issues. Basically, what was the call about? This is done through the wrap-up mechanisms on the telephone today. You have a paper list, and then you plug some data into the telephone that represents what the issue is about. It's summary information. You can take a product code, which is 3 digits, and then add on the UCC code, which is that level that I just told you about. It's just another digit. And then we have problem code digits that come after that. So if it's a specific problem with setup, we can know how many calls we got on that. This all goes back to the older days of support. Your support guys and you would go tell somebody about a problem, and they'd go, "How many calls did you get on it?" You'd go, "Oh, we don't know." And they'd say, "Well, if I can only fix 10 things, what are the 10 most important things for me to fix?" And you'd go, "Well, I don't know." This allows us to prioritize this stuff. Most important in the area of automated support, which eliminates the need for people to answer phones, is Fast Tips. This round-the-clock service, available over touch-tone phones, provides technical information on key areas of Microsoft products and answers to common questions. Another automated support system, MS Download, is an electronic bulletin board where Microsoft puts out new drivers, software that runs peripheral devices like printers, video screens, or pointing devices, product fixes, patches, and product notes. Users access this system over modems. PSS also runs the Microsoft Information Network. This includes the Microsoft Developer Network, which provides technical information to developers on CD-ROM disks, updated 4 times a year. It also includes the Microsoft TechNet, another CD-ROM database, updated monthly, that provides detailed product information and training information, as well as parts of the PSS Knowledge Base tool, the library of technical support information used by PSS support personnel. Feedback for product improvement. A key challenge for Microsoft is to organize and analyze the massive amounts of information it receives daily from customers from various sources. It must then channel this information in a useful and parsimonious form to the development groups. Handled correctly, this information can help development groups set priorities in fixing bugs, make products easier to use, and provide new features that customers really want. Another problem is that statistical summaries convey limited amounts of information. To exploit customer feedback, Microsoft recently established a product improvement group and introduced other mechanisms to analyze and channel customer information to the product groups. So many feature ideas and improvements have come from customer input that it is impossible to list them here. Key examples include product setup, the design philosophy behind drivers for printing and video displays in Windows, and standardization of toolbars and features across products. Managers also ask developers to spend more time making products easier to use and even have them answer telephone calls whenever Microsoft introduces a new product. These measures complement other types of user research and product usability testing. Product Improvement Initiatives. In 1991, Microsoft organized a product improvement group of about half a dozen senior PSS technicians. Each specializes in different products and acts as a consultant to the development organizations for those products. Mark Seidenberg, an Excel specialist, discussed the idea of such a group with Pete Higgins, Jeff Rakes, and Mike Maples, and then launched it, calling it Microsoft's secret weapon. We are called the Product Improvement Group, and we are product development consultants. Our mission is to help Microsoft better meet its customer needs, improve our products through customer feedback and suggestions. Our strategy to accomplish that is to develop methods, systems, procedures that will capture that information, quantify it, and deliver it in an easily testable format, meaningfully. It really means developing really great ways of boiling down a lot of anecdotal information into something statistically valid. The Product Improvement Group established two invaluable mechanisms for analyzing customer data: the monthly report called Offline Plus and a separate customer suggestion database. The report is organized primarily by the activities defined in the product, and it analyzes all the key information gathered from customer calls to Microsoft for the preceding month, broken down by product. Particularly important is a list of the top 10 reasons why customers contact PSS worldwide for each product. Microsoft distributes Offline Plus on paper and through electronic mail to individuals in the product groups as well as to managers. The main source of input for the suggestion database is the Microsoft Wish Lines, a phone number system that customers can call to make suggestions for new functions or features. Customers can also write in by letter. PSS staff transcribe the suggestions into a database available throughout the company. Issues of Offline Plus include the top 15 suggestions for each product. Problems and suggestions identified in Offline Plus get high visibility. Gates and other senior executives are avid readers. As a result, product groups generally respond within 3 or 4 hours to problems identified in the report and let PSS know what they intend to do about them. As Seidenberg observed, the communication loop works so that somebody from each product group comments back on each of our issues, saying basically, "Here's the problem," and they say what they're going to do about it or when they're going to do something about it. Sometimes they've already done things about those problems. Usually, a person from the testing group takes responsibility for logging the problems identified by PSS into their product group database and making sure that developers work on the problems that still exist. Program managers are concerned both with what features need fixing in the next version of the product and with customer suggestions for new features or feature changes. Individual products may get hundreds of suggestions from customers in any given month, so the prioritization that Seidenberg's group does is important. Now, all of those suggestions, too, and it varies for Excel between 2 and 600 a month, go into a database, and we not only review them monthly, but they are accumulated in a database. Then, during the planning process, all of those get reassigned back out to program managers, who go through them yet again. We don't want those things to get lost. We really feel like it is a competitive advantage. Your program managers own a set of features. They will say, "What are the calls you get on those features?" Then our job is to tell them in a really qualified and quantified way what needs to be fixed, or if there's a trade-off to be made, which is the best way to go on the trade-off, because everything just isn't that clean. The Product Improvement Group also holds intensive sessions with people in marketing, program management, development, testing, and user education from each product group. These sessions analyze in more depth why people call PSS for a particular product and what type of changes in features or in documentation might help reduce calls. Seidenberg referred to this as pre-morteming a new product. We spent 8 hours with about 80 people from the Excel business unit over a two-day period, reviewing everything that anybody calls about on any kind of regular basis. We do those surveys a few times a year. We do them for pre-mortemming a product and post-mortemming. As we go through the process, we'll collect a lot of information about how people are using our products and what problems they are having and what things they would like to see. And we will give them this huge 50 to 60 page document and a database. Then we start with the vision statement and the spec. Then, as we go through the spec, when we review the specifications, they'll say if they are doing this because of PSS stuff. And they'll ask us, does this solve the problem you told us about? Are customers going to understand this implementation? How should it be documented? Those kinds of things. So we get through the specification review side and the alpha code review. Then we go through a documentation review, where there's a person, an engineer, one of our group, that sits in on every piece of documentation creation to represent the customers. What do they need to know? What are the key concepts they need to understand? Reallocation of developers' time. Data from PSS have helped Microsoft shift the time that developers spend. Mike Maples recalled that when he joined Microsoft, developers mostly worked on new features. They paid little attention to making existing features easier to use or better in some other respect. What we'd like to do is have developers spend about a third of their time on improving what already exists, about a third of their time on new features, and about a third of their time on compatibility or consistency with the rest of the world. That could mean running Lotus spreadsheets or fitting into somebody's network or whatever, and or just being consistent or compatible with your past stuff. Before that, we would probably have thought that we would spend 80% or 90% of our time on new features instead of on features that make things simpler or better. PSS really helps us a lot figuring out what are those areas. Maples and other managers have also insisted that developers spend some time over in PSS to help staff the phone lines after shipping a new product. Administrative assistants in the groups take on the job of this scheduling. Some developers manage to avoid this duty when schedules are tight. In general, however, developers seem to feel that spending time in PSS is an important use of their time. It is useful both for developers to train and assist PSS staff, as well as to gain first-hand experience with users frustrated enough to call Microsoft directly. Brad Silverberg recalled when he started this practice in the systems group after his team introduced Windows 3.0 in 1990. Whenever we ship a product, for the next week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever is necessary, the development team is assigned to tech support. They have these big peaks, and they can't handle the demand, so developers go over there and train them. That was probably the first thing that I did when I came to Microsoft. Windows 3.0 had just launched, and it was a big success, and they were overwhelmed. So I sent my entire development team to product support for 2 weeks to help do the support. And it really does sensitize them to the customer. That's another philosophy of mine, which is to really get the developers, everybody, to take the end-user point of view. To remember that they're our boss, that the only reason we're successful is that they like our products. Maples was a strong supporter of this policy in the applications groups, where particular problems, such as mail merge, a feature in Word that allows a user to merge a list of addresses with a common data source, such as a form letter, have become infamous. Sending developers over to PSS both helps to sensitize the developers and give a signal to PSS people that their jobs are important, too. Maples described one of his visits. We try to get every developer to go sit for a day a quarter with PSS and just listen on the phones, and to encourage that, I go over and do that. I was walking around in the Word group one time, and they had this couch behind these guys. I said, "Well, what's that?" And they said, "That's the mail merge couch. Whenever we get a mail merge call, we know it's a 30-minute call, so a guy takes it and just walks over and lays on the couch and talks the user through it. An interesting problem to fix. But putting people over there makes the PSS guys feel a lot better. It's kind of the old Hawthorne effect. Just as importantly, they will hear and see the things that trigger that there is some area that needs to be improved. In addition, PSS has established the practice of holding Situation Room teleconferences twice a week or so after the launch of each new major product. These bring together an entire development team and link them with support technicians at Microsoft's different support locations, providing another close look at what types of problems customers are having. Microsoft also circulates minutes from the teleconferences to let other groups know what happens in these sessions. As with other process innovations, the Excel group started this practice. User research and usability testing. Apart from phone calls and other PSS contacts, Microsoft now utilizes a variety of mechanisms to study users in different contexts. These studies include research on user activities and products in the field, as well as testing product features under development. In other words, the usability lab analyses. PSS studies. Microsoft spends $500,000 per year on market research just on product support services and customer satisfaction. One major element is the annual End-User Customer Satisfaction Benchmark Survey, done by an outside research firm for Microsoft, which tries to measure customer satisfaction by identifying what is necessary to get and keep a customer. This survey covers more than 1,000 users, divided roughly in half between Microsoft and non-Microsoft users. The questions to Microsoft users analyze satisfaction with Microsoft products, with Microsoft as a company, and with Microsoft product support. Customers who are very satisfied in all three areas and who would definitely buy and definitely recommend Microsoft products rate as secure customers, users unlikely to switch to another company. The survey also compares satisfaction levels between Microsoft and key competitors and their products and support services. The data indicate a very tight relationship between product design and customer satisfaction with support and the company overall. For this reason, products designed for the Macintosh, which has an easier interface to use, tend to rate higher in customer satisfaction than Windows products, even though the products are practically identical. Trish May described this finding. There's some intercorrelation between the customer satisfaction rating and what products and how the product is designed. For example, we've done some cross-tabulations that show that if someone is very satisfied with the product, they're going to be very satisfied with the service. If you have an interactive user interface, then you're generally going to be more satisfied with the service. And there's sort of this halo interactive effect. Generally speaking, we have the same engineers answering a question on Mac Excel and on Windows Excel, so you sort of hold constant the person. The Macintosh interface is a little bit easier, or was in the past, and so we have higher satisfaction scores on some of our Mac Excel support questions than we do on Windows Excel in the early stages of the Windows development. The other major PSS survey is of customer satisfaction among callers to Microsoft. PSS people analyze these data monthly, looking at trends and asking a small percentage of the callers to participate in a 20-minute telephone survey. Data from these surveys suggest that Microsoft's efforts have worked. After relatively low satisfaction rates in the past, a recent tabulation indicated that 78% of customers were very satisfied with PSS, 64% would definitely repurchase, 61% would definitely recommend the product, and 54% were very satisfied with the product, resulting in a Microsoft product secure rate of 41%. Product usage studies. Microsoft relies on several mechanisms to understand user habits and needs by studying products in general use. In refining Word in the early 1990s, for example, Microsoft identified 200 WordPerfect users and studied them for a year by doing monthly interviews. Microsoft also does occasional segmentation studies in the United States, taking randomly selected phone numbers from different areas of the country and identifying 800 or so users willing to answer 20-minute questionnaires, about 50 questions. These provide general information on prototypical users of particular kinds of products. Microsoft also researches its user registration base by product, recognizing that these people may not be typical users. In addition, noted product manager Christine Wittress, marketing groups do detailed case studies of particular users, especially large corporate users, to gather information on customer needs and provide data for marketing publicity. Chris Peters recalled some of the key insights from the product usage studies. 20% of spreadsheet usage is simple list keeping, despite the power of the program. 40% of all documents are simple letters. 30% of all documents are memos, and only 5% of all documents are newsletters. Peters offered his conclusions. Basically, what is really found out is that usage of these products in real life is far simpler than anyone had ever imagined, which makes sense because we're now selling these products to millions and millions of people in Safeway stores. This research is actually one of the few things that is very confidential. We saw this as a significant competitive advantage, that we actually understood what pool we were selling to, and no one else did. Another important source of information has been Microsoft's instrumented product versions. These copies of the product have a separate file that records every mouse click and keystroke of a user, as well as how long it takes to perform each action. They are essential for studying how people actually use a product and what options they choose to accomplish particular tasks. Microsoft gives these special versions to companies that agree to serve as test sites, then studies the data as it comes in. Microsoft has done these studies for every new release of Excel and Word since the later 1980s, sending them out a few months after the first shipments. Groups use the data to improve or redesign the next version of the product. The instrumented version of Word was important to identify the mail merge feature, as well as various shortcuts for formatting documents. Other sources of user feedback are beta testers, who report back to Microsoft via the online CompuServe network. Beta testers primarily offer data on what bugs to fix before the final product release, but they also provide ideas for the next product version. As discussed in Chapter 5, users selected as beta testers sign a non-disclosure agreement, then get the software, as well as bug forms to fill out and return electronically. Usability lab testing. We described in Chapter 5 how Microsoft's usability lab provides another invaluable source of feedback on new products. Other software producers, ranging from IBM to Intuit, have had usability labs for many years to study how users react to potential new products and features. We believe Microsoft is distinctive, however, in the degree to which it has integrated this form of testing into its regular software development process. This is important because, unlike other sources of feedback, such as PSS data or beta test reports, product groups can gather this vital information during the development process, not before or after. The idea to institute regular usability lab testing began around the time Microsoft was developing Excel 3.0 in 1989 and 1990. Some developers were already testing product prototypes with prototypical users. They did not do this regularly, however, and Microsoft had no laboratory facility to analyze and collect data. Mike Maples recalled the origins of the lab. The Usability Lab is a group that started with a small number of folks. They're a service organization trying to help each product. To some extent, there was a real breakthrough there. If you went back 5 years ago when we started the usability group would tell the development group, 6 out of 10 couldn't do this. And the developer's reaction would be, where'd you find 6 dumb people? Then we started getting the developers into the usability lab, watching and participating. Then we did the instrumented versions. And then we got this idea of, as they were developing features, getting 6, 8, or 10 usability people and having the developers just walk around and talk to the users about what was working and what wasn't. And it's become a religious thing with the developers. Have you usability tested that? What did you find out? I think they realize that they don't think like their users think. Chris Peters, in 1989 and 1990, the development manager for Excel, had similar recollections of the lab's origin and growth in popularity. He emphasized that even Microsoft's best developers need more than their own common sense to make features easy to use. Moreover, Microsoft's smart developers did not realize their limitations until they saw users struggling with features in the usability lab. Since then, use of the lab has become routine. I don't know exactly the day, but it started happening around the Excel 3.0 time. We had some lucky accident where some of the developers were watching the usability test. When you actually see one live, 20 ideas just immediately come to mind. First of all, you immediately empathize with the person. The usual nonsense answer, well, they can just look in the manual if they don't know how to use it, or, my idea is brilliant. You just found 10 stupid people. That's why it doesn't work in the usability lab. That kind of stuff just goes out the door as soon as you see one live. It was just a very clear way of getting your stuff better. It was very obvious that you could make it better. People often thought that they could design based on common sense or being smart, but the way humans interact with software is way too complicated. Our best designers, and I think this is true for anybody, can get it about 60% right. And then the second time through, first time through the lab, they can usually boost it to 80%. By the third time through, they can usually get it to 90%. Getting something 60% right refers to the simple metric that Microsoft adopted to measure results in the lab. The number of people who, without referring to a manual, do a task correctly the first time, or the percentage of the task, such as the percentage of total steps, that people get correct the first time they try it. For example, a developer may ask a set of users to type in some text and then search for every instance of a word, for example, program, P-R-O-G-R-A-M-M-E, and automatically replace all cases with another spelling, for example, program, P-R-O-G-R-A-M. This task involves several steps within the search and replace feature. As Peters observed, developers put most features through the lab more than once in order to improve their usability. Some features, however, get low priority in the waiting line and do not go through the lab at all. One example is the feature to debug a macro on Excel. Very few people actually use this, and Microsoft expects those who do to be sophisticated. Therefore, developers are likely to skip testing this kind of feature in the lab. Conversely, a feature such as search and replace in Word has a high priority, because nearly everybody uses this. In some cases of high-priority features, developers might send a feature through the lab half a dozen times because they still get scores of only 50% or so. At this point, unless they have another good idea on how to fix the problem, they will redesign the feature or its user interface, or perhaps even cut it. The usability lab is available for all groups, although the applications groups take advantage of this most often. Peters explained why. The groups that have the religion use it more than groups that don't have the religion. Word and Excel, then most of the other applications, have the religion. Systems and languages are probably still further behind because they usually have more sophisticated users in general, so they get less of the problem in the first place. Systems developers tend to test for usability only interface features or functions that average users access, rather than functions that operate behind the scenes or that only other software developers are likely to access. Even PSS has gotten into the act. It employs the usability lab to test the effectiveness of different approaches to supporting new products and features. Mark Seidenberg described this. We actually usability test supportability. We've gone into the lab and said, given a customer has this problem, we're going to give this customer the manual and a telephone. We're going to set up a problem for them, and then they're going to call a technician who's in another part of the lab, and we're going to film them both and see them try to solve this problem. People whom Microsoft taps to test products in the usability lab can be anybody, such as people in user groups or from off the street. If developers want to check compatibility with a competing product, such as WordPerfect, they find a user of this product. They get a free coffee mug for coming in, Peters noted. Peters explained that we started branching out and doing this non-formal user kind of testing because the concept is a person who has never seen a feature before, when given a task, should do something. So now it's not uncommon for a developer to call in another developer who's next door and say, sit down, do this. Microsoft people also have discovered that it does not take a large group of users to test a feature. Peters commented on this finding. It's based on kind of a funny assumption, but it seems to be quite true that a small number of people will still all do the same thing. You'd think that with a user base of 10 individuals, you wouldn't get much data. But it turns out that if something is really wrong, you'll get a 0 for 10. And if you fix it, you'll get a 7 out of 10. People tend to mess up in similar ways. Peters listed his favorite lessons learned from observing users in the usability lab. One is that common sense on the part of the developer does not always lead to a product that is easy to understand and use. He gave the example of tools options, called tools preferences, on the Macintosh. Microsoft decided to put this in one place on Word 2.0 for Windows and adopt the Macintosh term. The objective of the usability lab testing was to see whether people could understand a multi-panel dialog menu if they had never seen one before. Only 1 out of 10 people brought up the dialog because they didn't understand the word preferences. They scanned past it. The task was to turn off the horizontal scroll bar. After the team changed the term to options instead of preferences, 5 or 6 out of 10 people got it right. The team also found that simply adding some explanatory text to the dialog box, such as explicitly saying, to see more options, click on the list at the left, greatly helped people find their way through the menus. This addition of text also did not slow down the operating speed. Now, noted Peters, in more modern dialogues, at least in Microsoft products, they usually contain more informative text. That was based on this. If you've run out of ideas on how to boost the usability score, usually adding text to the dialogue will help. After adding text, Peter's group got the usability score up to 6 or 7 out of 10. Then they put colorful icons on the left to draw further attention to the function, and the score improved to 8 or 9 out of 10. So there's an example where something went from 1 out of 10 to 8 out of 10 just based on dumb little changes, and I would maintain that none of those were common sense changes. A second lesson Peters learned is that manuals are largely unnecessary, because most people do not use them. The greater concept, which was the breakthrough, is that the manual doesn't have to exist, because that was the cop-out we always used in the past. Only 30% of users read the manual first when they do not understand a feature. Most users with a problem will initially consult a neighbor. If that does not work, they usually call product support. Only as a last resort will most customers consult the manual. Peters admitted that people in other companies, and to some extent in Microsoft as well, have complained that usability testing every feature during development can be too slow and expensive. Without some controls on this type of testing, it is possible for overzealous developers to spend years refining their features and never ship anything. He explained the cost objections. I've told this to lots of different companies, and they say that that sounds very expensive. We can't afford to do that. And I say you can always afford to, at least, first of all, admit that no one's going to open the manual, or the people will at least attempt a feature without a manual. And that a person who's unfamiliar with the design should see it, and you should pay attention to how they fail, even if it is just the programmer next door. So I think even a 10-person or a 5-person team working on something at MIT could benefit if they had that greater concept of, can this person do this task without a manual? And then watch them and pay attention. To reduce costs, Microsoft projects generally collect features that can be run together and test them at one time, and they try not to run features through the lab more than twice. Groups such as Excel and Word also try to limit their lab work to 2 half-day sessions per week, with each session testing about 3 features. The lab staff then sends reports to the developers and program managers. The program managers assigned to the feature, rather than the lab staff, also take responsibility for scheduling the testing. Maples tried to contain the cost of the lab as well, limiting the staff to around 35 people and the facilities to a half dozen or so actual rooms. Each room can have only 1 or 2 usability testers at a time. Microsoft has also maintained only 1 centralized lab, although Maples admitted there were pressures to create multiple facilities for the different design groups. He commented on this struggle to run an economical usability lab. "There's virtually no guideline, and the usability lab is 200% or 300% oversubscribed because it's become such an important part of the product that everybody wants to do it to everything. The usability lab would like to have 100 people and 50 labs, but anytime you have a free service, it's pretty hard to tell what the trade-offs are. What we're in the process of doing is breaking the design group up, and we'll probably do the same thing with usability. As soon as it gets big enough that we can make multiple groups and put it closer to the customers and make the trade-off of what they do a smarter trade-off, we'll do that. The other reason it's centralized is that it started off as 2 people, and you do have the problem of the facilities." The lab has had concrete benefits in making products easier to use and easier to support, as PSS data indicates. In fact, Peters credited the usability lab with halving the number of customer calls per box sold. "No one's ever happy to call product support, so it's a fine example of where there's a total win-win situation. If you can make it so they don't need the call, you win. And they don't want to call in the first place, so they win." Peters also claimed that the lab has helped prevent program managers and developers from adding too many unnecessary and complex features. "This feature creep is a concern among many users frustrated with the growing size of PC software products and the amount of memory and storage space they require. We think that, with usability testing, we can actually add more features and make a product easier and easier to use. So we no longer think that feature creep actually applies if you do things right. That implies that there's a trade-off between power and ease of use. So much so had that gotten indoctrinated in the industry that people were starting to do things like executive word processors, i.e., we can't make this thing easier to use, so we'll just start deleting features. But I think the right way, actually, is to use usability testing so you can have power and ease of use. I don't think they are opposites." Principle: promote linkages and sharing across product groups. A final issue in building a learning organization is for different product groups to learn how to share components and work together as an integrated company. Microsoft's increasing emphasis on integrated, feature-rich products, such as Office and Windows 95, now demands a systematic approach to designing interfaces, sharing components, and improving consistency in project scheduling and product quality. Microsoft and other software producers can no longer afford to keep large, independent product groups and let them reinvent the wheel as they please at the expense of profits and customer complaints about inconsistencies or incompatibilities across the same company's product portfolio. At one point, for example, Microsoft managers determined they had 14 different collections of text processing code in their products. They also had several versions of code that did math calculations, graphing and charting, help functions, and other tasks. Microsoft now has a variety of linkages and communication ties across product groups to facilitate component sharing and feature standardization across their products. Beyond just explicit reuse of designs and code, projects are working to define component-based architectures. They are also building individual components that different products can utilize through mechanisms such as dynamic link libraries, DLL, or object linking and embedding, OLE. This component-based architecture approach contrasts with Microsoft's earlier approach of building primarily standalone applications. Applications products, especially Office, need to reuse shared components, such as a toolbar, drawing tool, or window frame, in order to provide a consistent user interface to customers. This reuse also decreases the effort required to add new capabilities to individual applications. At the same time, standardizing and sharing components reduce effort needed in customer service to support similar functions done somewhat differently in different products. Interoperability group. Learning how to share has not been easy. Microsoft has actually taken several years to achieve systematic sharing of components across its different product units, and it can still do more. Bill Gates has had to play a major role by mandating that new product versions incorporate the OLE technology and pursue sharing in other ways as well. One of Microsoft's first steps in this direction was to create an interoperability committee and then an interoperability group several years ago. The latter included OLE, the Interoperability Design Group, the original Office Group, the group that integrated Office and shipped it as a product, the Usability Testing Group, and the Visual Interface Design Group. In 1993, the Interoperability Group evolved into the current Office product unit. The Interoperability Group worked to persuade the separate applications groups to adopt common user interfaces, such as standardized menus and toolbars, and then identified common functions across the major products. According to Dave Moore, the Interoperability Group, which had 26 people in 1993, was designed to be a third party to work with the Excel and Word groups. If there was a disagreement or a deadlock between those two groups on how to design a common feature, the Interoperability Group was there to make the decision. It's the third leg of the stool. You've got to make decisions. And so, if Excel and Word can't decide, you have a third party. Any function that is common between the two products, file open, file close, copy, paste, anything you see in one that has the same function in the other, they're working to make sure that the function is presented in exactly the same way. If there's a dialogue that opens, the dialogue is exactly the same. The controls for the dialogue operate exactly the same way. Interoperability personnel emphasize consistency from the end-user perspective, not consistency in the sense of code reuse. The interoperability group did not review people's code to ensure commonality, but rather focused on the specification, making sure that developers designed the commonality into the feature. Developers can code the feature in different ways, but it must appear the same to the user in both programs. Without the presence of a group whose focus is making features look and behave the same, the user interfaces produced by major product groups simply diverge as they focus solely on making best-of-class products. The interoperability group led the identification of a common or core set of features across products. As Chris Graham, former director of Applications Interoperability, summarized, "We created the position of apps interoperability because we felt that suites of applications are becoming very, very important in the market. And the only way we're going to get our products to work well together is by putting good people on it and devoting a significant effort. The entropy of separate product groups focusing on making the best products in their category just causes things to diverge. It's easier to make decisions if you just want to be the best spreadsheet or the best word processor, but it's much harder to work with the other group to reach a consensus on doing something the same way. So we created the interoperability group to get OLE into the applications and to develop what we call the core feature set that we would get into not just Word and Excel, but other applications. This is just a very simplistic view of what we mean by core functions. They're worksheet features, word processing, database, and so on. They're a set of features that are common to all applications and are frequently enough used by users that they encounter them in all applications and expect them to work the same. An important reason for the success of these efforts in interoperability and sharing has been the tireless efforts of key managers such as Chris Graham. Born in 1949 in Ireland and raised in Vancouver, Canada, Graham studied applied science and engineering at the University of British Columbia, then worked as a software developer, consultant, and manager at various firms before joining Microsoft in 1989. He initially worked in a four-person group that explored ways to standardize the architectures across Microsoft's major applications products. This group made little progress, and within 4 months, Graham switched to the Excel group as a program manager. There he headed a feature team that tried to redefine the architecture of Excel, as well as achieve compatibility with Lotus 1-2-3. Within 3 months, he took over as the group program manager for Excel. He then became Director of Applications Interoperability, overseeing OLE development, interoperability design, visual interface design, and coordination for the Office product. After the fall 1993 reorganization, Graham briefly worked as head of the interoperability design group within the new Office product unit, reporting to Chris Peters. He later took a leave of absence before moving on to another assignment, although other people have continued this effort to promote the design and use of common features. Core set of common features. In 1993, the interoperability group identified about 35 major features that were common but not shared among products. Microsoft then created a process whereby particular product groups that had the expertise, such as the Word business unit with text processing code or the Excel business unit with math calculations code, took the lead in building a particular feature and encapsulating it using OLE. Other groups adopted the OLE interfaces so they could incorporate those features as objects into their programs. This became an ongoing process of redesigning and sharing, as now seen primarily in the Office suite of applications. Microsoft wanted users to perceive that its products looked and behaved similarly. Chris Graham elaborated, "We want to make the Microsoft products look like a family of products, and so we want people to immediately perceive that within the first 10 minutes of using a group of products. We want people to feel that they're the same, so the features need to be consistent that people see first or use most frequently. The product should act like they're part of the family. They should work together well." The core set of common features includes toolbars, copy, cut, paste features, fonts, dialog boxes for printing, and various menus. Microsoft research indicates that roughly 85% of users' actions require about 35 product features. The common feature set defines these features and specifies their user interface appearance, as well as the behavior of the buttons, menus, dialog boxes, and other items. The marginal returns of making consistent the hundreds of remaining features diminish rapidly, as Graham recalled. "For this round, we were fortunate in that of the hundreds of features, about 85% of what users do are only about 35 features. All the rest are things that users don't do very much, so you wouldn't gain much by making them consistent. So by concentrating on 35 features, although that's maybe only 10% of the total features, it's 85% to 90% of what users experience. So there's a lot of bang for the buck. As you go to less frequently used features, there's a rapidly diminishing return." Within the set of 35 features, most users would say that 25 to 50% of them already look and behave pretty consistently in existing products such as Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Interoperability people, however, note that at least 50% of the common features have significant differences across the products. Jim Connor, Program Manager for Applications Interoperability, commented, "In about at least 25% of the cases, and maybe as many as 50% of the cases, the degree of consistency is pretty good. I think most naive users who look at these different implementations would say, 'Oh yeah, that's pretty much the same.' In at least 50% of the cases, there are significant differences. Some of those are justified by functional differences among the products, they really need an extra button because they do different things. But I would say that at least 25% of the visual elements or functional elements of those features are randomly different. Gathering data on common features. Microsoft people gathered extensive data on what features to include in the common set. First, they considered and evaluated more than 300 features from their major products, such as Excel, Word, PowerPoint, Publisher, Project, and Windows. Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and Project alone have a total of over 600 features, so Microsoft initially considered only a likely subset of all existing features. Second, they used instrumented versions of Excel and Word to gather detailed usage and frequency data for features. They then generated estimates for the other products. Graham noted that they tabulated the command usage frequency based on discussions with users and instrumentation data. We considered maybe 300 features. We did a lot of research to determine what are the most leveraged set of features. I realize that it's very hard to get a consensus on designs across a lot of groups, so we need to develop a process where we pick the most important things and make sure we do those really well. So we talked to a lot of users. We used instrumented versions of the products, so we know how frequently users do various actions. Finally, the team supplemented this information with insights from activity-based planning. See the detailed discussion of this technique in Chapter 4. The activity study showed, for example, that users transferred data between products quite frequently, and this highlighted the importance of common cut-copy-paste operations, as well as preserving fonts and other formatting across products. Users also want to build compound documents that include text, data, and graphics. As Graham explained, it turns out that, not surprisingly, the most important integration activity was copying and pasting or cutting and pasting between applications. So that was one we concentrated on. Another one was building compound documents. We used activity-based planning as a way of determining the features we do. What are the common activities that users experience when working with a family of products? Transferring data between products is a common activity. Then you have to break it down into what types of transfers are common, which directions is the data transferred, what problems are users experiencing, what's their real intent, rather than what they're doing today. So you think about the user's activity. Then you break it down into what are the things which you can do to make the most difference. So for each of the features, we did a write-up of the activities that users go through more globally, rather than just concentrating on, get this feature the same. Office Integrated Product Suite. Microsoft introduced the Office Product Suite as a shrink-wrapped collection of the major applications products, Excel, Word, PowerPoint, Access, and Mail. As we discussed in Chapter 3, Microsoft has priced Office very aggressively, and it has sold tremendously well, with approximately 15 million copies now in use. Chris Graham exclaimed, "They buy Office. More than 50% of our sales of Word and Excel are as part of Office now. We would like to see that go as high as we can push it." Initially, the applications products packaged in Office had no additional integration or cooperation among themselves beyond what they had as standalone products. The only value added of Office was the convenience of buying them all at once and, of course, the heavily discounted price. The interoperability people wanted to increase dramatically the degree of sharing and integration in the Office suite. Their common feature set research enabled them to affect the architecture of Office so that it now has better user interface consistency and a component-based architecture approach. Office 4.0 shipped in October 1993 and provided users, for example, with a consistent appearance across the different applications. Most of the top-level menu items are identical across Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, as Bill Gates observed. "We've been very rigid across the product groups in imposing a standard. So we can see at the very top level in all of these products that 8 of the 9 top-level menu items are absolutely identical. The only thing that's different is that in the word processor, you have the table command, in PowerPoint, you have draw, in Excel, you have data. So that seventh menu item is specific to the application. If you go down the level below this, you'll find that all the commands in File and Edit and Window, anything that's shared between these applications, even the dialog box you get, will work in exactly the same way. That's just an enabling step. That's to make it comfortable for people to think of this as a single application, as opposed to several different applications. The Office product unit now has 24 dedicated developers. They build most of the shared components themselves, although Microsoft contracts with external companies to build some specialized components. The Office project also has a single coordinated schedule for building all of its applications, Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and so on, and shared components. The matrix feature team structure ensures that the shared components meet the needs of the individual applications. A matrix feature team for a particular set of features includes Office developers as well as representatives from the relevant applications, as Graham illustrated. This is another tool that we use to manage the interoperability process. We created feature teams like matrix feature teams, where there were representatives from each group on a particular feature area. And so here we have Excel, Word, PowerPoint, Mail, Project, and so on. These are the representatives on the feature teams. Office managers and developers have to spend extra time and effort to coordinate these features with the individual applications. But the charter of the Office group is to provide infrastructure for them, as John Devon acknowledged. We're in this situation where we're just getting bootstrapped with building a set of shared code that everyone uses. There's a lot of pain in that. One of the particular pains is that the Office people have to work really hard to understand how things work today in the client applications. We have to go through a process of validating our designs with them. That causes a bunch of overhead relative to what it was like when we were a single product developer. The job of the Office development group is to provide more infrastructure for those applications. Projects outside Office, such as Publisher and Works, are also increasing their use of components from the Office group. The Excel and Word teams initially resisted the Office concept because it would not necessarily help make Excel a better spreadsheet application or Word a better text processing application. But Microsoft's use of the Office approach has given customers a better integrated application set. Consumers voted with their dollars by buying Office instead of the individual applications, so the Excel and Word teams compromised. Excel and Word developers also realized that a major technical advantage of the Office approach is less memory usage by the individual applications. This either frees more memory for other more specialized purposes or improves user response time. Decreased memory usage provides another competitive advantage, according to Graham. If you take half of Word, half of Excel, half of PowerPoint, and take those away, that's a big reduction in the working set, memory size, for an Office user. And it would be a big incentive for someone to buy Office, as compared to standalone applications from Borland, WordPerfect, and Lotus, where they don't share code. Interdependencies among products and components. The component-based approach has led to significantly increased inter-product dependencies, which can work against achieving goals such as creating excellent individual products, improving on-time delivery, or maintaining the daily build philosophy. Projects previously developed single products where they implemented and controlled their own code. Now, projects depend on groups outside their own team to produce components they critically need. Projects try to track the progress of their needed components very closely by monitoring as many of the component providers' internal milestones as possible. John Fine, Group Program Manager for Excel, told us that one trick that works really well is you make sure to write down and track many milestones, events that must occur. If I'm a component user, I want to track for my component provider many milestones that occur at short durations of time. That gives me a tool to check on the progress of my component provider. Component providers and component users also need to communicate frequently to make sure that they both have a clear, current understanding of the component's features, interfaces, and schedule. Fine continued, "The fundamental problem is a lack of communication. The component provider will make assumptions over the days and weeks of the project that the component user doesn't know about, or vice versa. Then they discover that later, and therefore they each did work that ends up having to get thrown away, or it's inefficient. So any kind of critical path scheduling doesn't help. What helps is over and over again, at short intervals of time, for both of those groups to ask the other group. Verify for themselves that all of the things that the other group is doing, they're really doing, and the things they think they're not doing, they're really not doing. A project that provides a component to no more than two users usually has a very tight, effective working relationship. Component providers who have one or two users can stay in constant communication with them, and they can more accurately estimate the component availability date because the specification for the component tends to change more predictably. The developers for Visual Basic for Applications, VBA, for example, first provide the VBA component to Excel and then consider other users. Dave Moore emphasized this. What really works best is only two clients. There you can service all their needs, you know exactly what they want, you're always providing what they want. A very nice relationship. The applications group in the past typically had only one client, so it was very easy to fix the ship date, fix the number of resources, fix the feature set, fix the performance. In some cases, there were two clients. Maybe you're looking at your strict end users, home users, and here's corporate users. It's very easy to specify what they wanted. Systems projects always provide components in the sense that an operating system constitutes a very large component that users need to run applications. This component provider-user perspective results in another major difference between applications and systems products. Systems products have many more component users than do applications, and component providers with large numbers of users tend to have more difficulty predicting their ship dates, as Moore described. The systems group is providing a component. They're providing all these services. What you find with a component provider who has probably more than 10 clients is they need to service the requirements of those 10 clients, and they have to get it right. They can't necessarily service an individual client. They have to work extremely hard to satisfy all the needs of those clients. That's extremely difficult. There's a major difference in building that kind of product as opposed to a component provider who's working for 3 to 9 clients. Systems are always providing for 10 or more clients. What are the needs of a spreadsheet developer? What are the needs of a word processor developer? What are the needs of a desktop publishing developer? What are the needs for all these diverse sets of applications working in this environment? There were requirements coming from multiple vendors who are also working on spreadsheets. A spreadsheet developer